I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The Liquor Control Board pulled the plug on the wine kiosks that have been placed in some of Pennsylvania's supermarkets. There's reportedly a dispute with a company that owns the machines, and at this point, there's a lot of finger-pointing going on. It does end a program started a year ago in an effort to make liquor sales in the state more customer-friendly. There are calls to privatize liquor sales in the legislature, and the governor campaigned on this issue. We're curious, did you ever use one of those wine kiosks? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We asked Brad Bumstead to join us, and he's Capitol reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, joins us from their newsroom. And Brad Bumstead, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What was the thinking behind these wine kiosks?
Well, it appears that as privatization efforts were seemed imminent in the following year, the Liquor Control Board was looking for a way to tell consumers that, you know, by keeping the system, we can still provide the kind of service you want and enable you to get wine in grocery stores like you can do in some other states. Of course, you had to do it out of these 10-foot machines and blow a breathalyzer and then slide your credit card, and a lot of people found it inconvenient. It never really latched on with consumers, and it's been downhill since.
Did you ever use one, Brad?
I never did. I wouldn't admit to it, but no, I never have.
But you never had. But the idea was to make the purchase of liquor in Pennsylvania easier for the consumer.
Make it more convenient, and I think it also had a political purpose, and that was to show, look, you don't need to privatize liquor and wine sales. There are other ways of doing this within our current system.
Did it make money? Did it lose money, these wine kiosks?
They, as of August, asked for some figures and made about $1 million, $1.2 million, which is about the size of a small liquor store, an LCB store revenue in the state. So it didn't make a lot of money. It was more symbolic, both to proponents and opponents of privatizing the system.
Does this hurt the LCB, the Liquor Control Board?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a small part of the overall debate. Of course, the House Majority Leader Mike Terzai, who's the leading proponent of privatizing the stores, jumped on this when the LCB announced that it was pulling the plugs on the kiosk, talking about what a horrendous mistake it was, and we never should have done it, and I told you so in big letters. But it's not fundamental to the debate, which is going to revolve around how much money you could bring in by selling the wholesale and retail operation of the state store, and the philosophical argument that Corbett and Terzai say we need to embrace, and that is, should the state be selling liquor in the first place?
And that's certainly what the governor campaigned on. The Liquor Control Board, though, defended these wine kiosks, saying, look, this is innovation. We're trying something that hasn't been tried before, and obviously an attempt to try to bring some reforms to the system.
Well, that's right. Joe Conte, the CEO of the board, was up here in the Capitol newsroom earlier this week, and it's exactly what he talked about. And he said, you know, there was some risk with innovation. They knew that, but they took this chance, and it didn't work out. Now it appears headed to litigation. Both sides have claims on that, so that may be a long time till it's resolved, and it may be expensive. But Conte, in effect, is saying, don't punish us for being innovative.
And I guess the machines being removed from the supermarkets?
Yeah, I don't know exactly when that's going to occur, but it's a minor piece of this debate, which is going to come to the surface again very soon, because there's a report due to Corbett from Public Financial Management, and it's supposed to assess the whole system and look at what the value would be of selling the state stores. And that's, I don't want to say imminent, but very soon that something on that may be announced.
And that's Brad Bumstead. He's Capitol reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, essentially getting us all up to speed on the fate of liquor sales in the state of Pennsylvania. And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We were curious whether you ever used those wine kiosks that are being removed, and what you think about privatizing liquor sales in Pennsylvania. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Brad, the Pennsylvania auditor, Jack Wagner, though, had an interesting report basically saying that the state is actually making money off of liquor sales. Maybe it's not as much money as it has made in the past. But what was the auditor saying?
Well, he was saying don't give up a sure thing, that this has worked well over the years. There's guaranteed revenue here in terms of the sales. And there is. I mean, it makes the LCB brings in something like $500 million a year that's turned over to the state's general fund. Mm-hmm. And critics of privatization say, well, how would you make up that money? You can't guarantee you would get that kind of income once you sell the stores. But Terzai and others say that three-fourths or more of that money that's turned over to the state is from taxes, and the state would still get that money. So there's maybe 80 to 100 million, depending on who's talking, that the state might be out on paper with privatization. And that's, Wagner was talking about that. He's the state's auditor general, the state's fiscal watchdog, an important voice in all of this, no question, but it's really going to be decided on the value, the tax system that's proposed, how consumers would be affected, and whether people believe we should be in this or not. Look, if you look at polls that have been done over the past couple years, Pennsylvanians overwhelmingly approve of selling the state stores. Polls have come in 60-70% range. Favorability of selling the state stores. The problem comes in when the devil is always in the details. That's always the case in legislation. And, that's going to be one of the issues here, too, is, how much would a bottle of wine cost under a privatized system, a bottle of liquor? Are you really saving much money? Those are the kind of points that are being talked about.
And interestingly, on the other side is the union. That makes sense.
Yes.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving and some religious conservative organizations.
Right. That's the coalition that on two previous occasions was able to defeat, if you will, privatization efforts, going back to when Republican Governor Dick Thornburgh was in office and Republican Governor Tom Ridge. They both tried to sell the liquor system and, came face to face with that coalition. However, it appears that things are somewhat different now. While the union, particularly UFCW and Wendell Young of Philadelphia area, is a formidable opponent in all of this, it's not clear that coalition still exists. I called Mothers Against Drunk Driving and, their national office to see if they were taking part in all of this, and they apparently have other priorities at this point. And I'm not saying they would be not be involved at all, but it doesn't seem like it was in the past that they are going to be active. The religious coalition undoubtedly still opposes all of this, but one thing that's changed over the past 20 years, as we've looked at this from Thornburgh and Ridge, is all of the surrounding states where Pennsylvanians travel to, go to on vacation, have some form of private sales. Pennsylvanians see that and know that the world isn't going to come to an end if they do that. In other words, they're more familiar with it. Some may not like it, that's true, but it's not as foreign of a concept as it seemed in the 1980s.
Well, even the price of liquor in Pennsylvania, there's a 30% markup, but there's also a tax, the Johnstown flood tax, it goes back to 1936. It's an 18% tax on the sale of liquor. Do you think, Brad, that if the system is privatized, some of that markup will go away?
That's the key issue. They would, Terzai would eliminate the Johnstown flood tax and replace it with a gallonage tax. Then the private system would mark up the bottles for profit, and whether it's above the 30%, below, is debated. I've heard it from 20% to 40%. Who knows? One thing that proponents would say is, yeah, but it's going to be competitive. This will no longer be a monopoly, so retailers are going to have to be careful with that markup because the guy across town selling a bottle might have some big sale on it. So you can't assume that it's going to be a straight across the board markup for private industry of X percent.
Brad, help us understand Jonathan Newman's change of heart. Now, he's a former chair of the LCB, and he has become a critic of the system. Do you know why?
I don't, and I haven't spoken with Jonathan about it. I knew him when he was chairman of the LCB, and I wrote a profile about him at the time. Very impressive figure. I mean, he is believed to have done more for improving the system than just about any single individual. Gets very high marks, and he of course initiated the chairman's selection, which has been very popular. And here's another intangible, and it goes hand in hand with Newman, and that is that the state stores have improved enormously over the past 25 years. I can remember back in the 1970s, you would go in a state store, and it really was like a Soviet-style, had that feel of this very closed system where you would walk in, and all the bottles were in the back, and you couldn't see them. And you had to, you know, write down on a slip for the clerk what you wanted, and he would go back and, you know, get the bottle and bring it out. They didn't want you to see it. It was all part of the Prohibition era concept of not tempting you to drink certain things, you know. So you would write the bottle on a slip of paper and get your liquor that way. And the clerks were rude. It was a very cumbersome system. And you look at some of the stores now, they're pretty nice. So that has changed and taken away part of the argument there anyway, or at least dented it.
And Brad, we're almost out of time here. As you mentioned, former governors Ridge Thornburg tried to privatize the system. Do you think Governor Corbett will get what he campaigned on?
There is a $64,000 question, and it's unclear. It seems that Terzai, who's pulling out all stops to get this through the House, would have the juice as majority leader to win a House vote on this. But that's going to be tough. It won't be easy. The Senate, meanwhile, has sort of turned a cold shoulder on all of this, and they're like, well, we're not interested in doing this. And Joe Scarnati and Dominic Pileggi, two Republican leaders, have indicated this isn't a priority. But all of this, of course, builds up to the possibility of a trade, you know, on various things that leaders in both chambers and Corbett want.
Well, and Brad, we have to leave it there, and thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Brad Bumstead, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And
bye.
We're going to take a very short break and get back to another conversation. Stay with us.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Prostate cancer is second only to skin cancer among U.S. men. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase's Prostate Cancer Risk Assessment Service helps you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of your family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, hearts plus minds.
Next time on APM SymphonyCast, we're at the BBC Proms, where music enthusiasts queued up early to get a prime spot to hear one of the best ensembles in the world, the Philadelphia Orchestra. Hi, I'm Allison Young. It's one of our own playing in London with music that was written just for them. That's coming up on APM SymphonyCast.
Sunday night at 8 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss Cohen. After being held for almost 26 months, two American hikers, Josh Fatal and Shane Bauer, were released yesterday from Evin prison in Iran. They were flown to Oman, where they were met by their families in a joyous reunion. Last month, they had been found guilty of espionage and sentenced to 8 years in prison, a charge they denied. Joining us to talk about the hikers' capture and release is Hala Esfandiari. In 2007, she was held in solitary confinement for 105 days in the same prison and wrote about her experiences in a memoir, My Prison, My Home. She directs the Woodrow Wilson Center's Middle East program. And Hala Esfandiari, it's a great pleasure to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great pleasure to be back.
Well, nice to have you back. And I know you can't get in the mind or the hearts of Josh Fatal and Shane Bauer, but you're about as close as we can get. What do you think that they are experiencing today?
It's a sense of elation, happiness, joy, and adjusting to having freedom of movement, adjusting to not to worry what you say, adjusting to being surrounded by loved ones, all that.
And do you have advice or concerns for them? There's been so much international interest in their case. You know, we, along with everyone else, lining up to set up an interview with them and their families. What do you suggest they do about all this publicity and interest?
Marty, I don't think they were, while in prison, they were aware of this international campaign, just like I was not. And of course, now they are going to be told by their family, you know, what has been going on for the last 26 months, which is very comforting for them, because when you are in solitary confinement or when you are in prison, you feel you are completely abandoned. And they had just one visit in those 26 months by their mothers. So I think they have to first find out that the whole world had not forgotten them. On the contrary, they were pushing for their release. And secondly, they have to listen to their mothers to tell them what happened. And also the parents, the families have to listen to their stories. Don't forget they have suppressed and repressed 26 months of what happened to them in that horrible place. So they need to talk about it to get it out of their system, and then I think they will face the press.
And I guess what happens when held in confinement like that, especially when accused of something you said you didn't do, and that was true in your case as well, you repress some of those memories, some of the feelings that you have just to cope?
You definitely do that. I mean, in their case, they even didn't speak the language, so they had it even harder than I had. Everything had to go through a translator, during the interrogation and then in court. At least I was able to communicate with my interrogators, you know, answer them or tell them this is not the case, what you are telling me. But you keep on thinking about your answers when you go back to your cell and say, maybe I should formulate it slightly differently next time.
You were very thin when you were released from Evin prison, and they look very thin as well. Does that mean you didn't get enough to eat?
I can only talk about my case. I just couldn't stand prison food, to be very honest with you. I didn't trust prison food because I wasn't sure whether they would put drugs in it, you know, to drug me. So I insisted on eating just fruit and vegetables that I could peel myself. And I'm sure that prison food is not the best cuisine that you can get. Mm-hmm. So, and especially Josh and Shane were not used to even the Persian food, so it took them a while to just get used to it. And secondly, it's so repetitive. It's the same stuff over and over again. So after some time, you don't feel like eating. And also, it's the agony, the pressure that leads to your losing weight.
Evin Prison is also is often called the notorious Evin Prison. Is that where foreigners are held?
I don't know. I really don't know. But what we have recently read, it is where foreigners are at least brought for a period of time. They are staying there because probably they have one interpreter who can always come and translate. But it is notorious because a lot of prisoners have been tortured there, have been killed there, never, you know, they entered Evin, were never heard of. And there are, you know, there are a lot of examples that we know of. For example, the Canadian-Iranian journalist was beaten to death in Evin prison, a woman, you know, in 2006. So these are the kind of things that we are familiar with.
When you were in solitary confinement, and this was 105 days back in 2007, what did you do all day?
Well, first of all, most of the time, I would say 6 days a week or sometimes 7 days a week, I had to go for interrogation, which lasted 8 to 9 hours a day. But if I was not taken for interrogation, I would walk in my cell. I would do Pilates exercise. I started going over the question and answers from the interrogation to make sure that I remember what I told them. And also, I wrote 2 books in my head. You know, 105 days solitary confinement is a very long time, you know, and I was kept in the summer where the sun rose at 4:30 in the morning and didn't set till 9:30 at night. So I had very long days. So I tried to occupy myself, but there was one thing I didn't do, and that was I never, never, never thought about my family, because I knew if I think about my family, I would break down.
And you could control those thoughts?
I could.
You learned to do that, I guess?
I did. I'm a very disciplined person, so I forced myself, you know. And I also accepted the possibility that they may not release me in, you know, within 1 or 2 years. So I have to put up with this surrounding.
Could you hear other prisoners?
No.
No.
You know, if you are in solitary confinement, the door is always shut, and there is a little window, so when a prisoner would pass that corridor, the guard would come and shut even that little opening. So, no, I never saw anyone.
It was silence?
Yeah, because the walls are... Sometimes, you know, you could hear people passing in the corridor talking to each other, but I never heard any sound from the other cells, you know.
And that's Hala Esfandiari. She was held in solitary confinement for 105 days in 2007 in the same prison where Josh Vital and Shane Bauer were held for almost 26 months. They were released yesterday from Evin prison, flown to Oman, met by their families, a joyous reunion. Today's papers, of course, with photographs of that joyous reunion. And Hala Esfandiari, one of the people that had criticized the Iranian regime for holding these two hikers, she wrote a memoir called My Prison, My Home, and she currently directs the Woodrow Wilson Center's Middle East program. Any questions you might have at 1-888-477-9499. Do give us a call, and that's 1-888-477-WHYY. Now, last month, Josh Fatale, Shane Bauer were found guilty of espionage and actually sentenced to 8 years in prison. In the last week or so, it was unclear whether they were going to get released or not. Ahmadinejad would say one thing and then we'd hear something else. Can you help us understand what you think might have been going on inside of Iran as the fate of these two men were being discussed?
I think they had come, the regime had come to a political decision that to release the hikers. But Ahmadinejad jumped the gun last week. When he gave that interview and said that they would be released in 2 days or in a couple of days, the judiciary got very upset and they came out and said that this is such a decision is taken by the judiciary and not by the president. So that caused the delay, you know. And then the lawyer came and started that story of there were two judges, one had signed to the release, the other one was on holiday. I don't think I've ever heard such a story. But my sense is that because the President Ahmadinejad is in a weaker position than he used to be, there are so many differences going on between this different center of powers in Iran that the judiciary just decided to undermine him by postponing the release.
But do you think there was also timing because Ahmadinejad speaking at the UN this week?
I just think that they didn't want Ahmadinejad to release the hikers before he comes to the UN and, get the credit for it. Basically, the message that was sent from Iran was that Ahmadinejad does not take the credit for releasing the hikers. It is the supreme leader who finally took the decision that this matter should come to an end.
And that tells us something about the divisions in Iran?
Oh, sure.
Between the president and the supreme leader and the judiciary?
Exactly. And parliament, you know. I mean, there are so many divisions going on currently in Iran. And the president is no longer in the strong position he was 2 years ago in 2009 after he was re-elected through those manipulated elections.
Now, Oman played a critical role in the release of Shane Bauer and Josh Fatale. Help us understand their role in this region of the world.
You know, it's very interesting that we all talk about Oman while the Iranian foreign ministry announced that it was the Secretary General of the UN. It was, of course, the Sultan of Oman. It was President Chavez. It was President Talibani, who all intervened on behalf of the hikers. But basically, we know that the force that really pushed both the release of Sarah Short a year ago, the third hiker, in September, and also these two hikers now, was the Omani government. Oman has very good relations with Iran, and Oman has very good relations with the United States. And I think that they wanted to just show the United States that they can be influential when it comes to negotiating with Iran, and they, at the end, manage to pull all the strings together and deliver the two hikers.
Now, something like $500,000 was, I don't know if it was called bail, is it ransom? How should we understand the money that was paid related to their release?
This is part of the judiciary system in Iran. I was released on $350,000 bail. We didn't have the cash. By we, I mean my family in Iran. So my mother had to put the deed of her apartment as bail, you see. And it's still, the apartment still is there as bail, and they had not lifted it. So this is part of the system in Iran. If you want to release a prisoner on a temporary basis, you put a bail on it. That means that if you then announce that they have to appear in court, if they don't come, they confiscate your bail. Hmm. So if the Iranian regime decides to put Sarah, Josh, and Shane on trial again, you know, then and they don't show up and they're found guilty, then they would take the bail.
Now, they were charged with espionage. You were charged with spying as well.
Yes.
Is that the sort of typical charge in circumstances like this?
I just think it is. In my case, it was trying to promote a velvet revolution to overthrow the regime. And I kept on always, whenever they said it, I kept on laughing and saying, if such a strong power in the Persian Gulf can be threatened by an old woman, I was then 67 years old, I mean, then really they are the equivalent of a banana republic, you know. So, but there is a fear and phobia of the intelligence ministry. They believe that the United States is doing anything possible to overthrow the regime, and they, I think, arrested the hikers who were just hiking there, again, within that frame of mind. And that's why I was arrested, and the number of other dual citizens were arrested.
Do you think Iran gained anything from holding and charging Josh Fatale and Shane Bauer?
Absolutely not. I think it was a waste of these two young men's lives. It was a total waste of energy for the Iranian government. They turned themselves into a laughingstock, you know, around the world. There was so much pressure on them. And at the end, you know, they convicted them to 8 years imprisonment, and then they released them, thank God. So it's just ridiculous, you know.
We have just a minute before we have to say goodbye. And as you said, you were accused of helping this velvet revolution, or I guess green revolution.
Yeah.
Where's that revolution today? And I ask that, of course, knowing about the Arab Spring of this year.
Mm-hmm. Look, the green revolution is dormant. The green movement is dormant. It's not dead. They are there. You know, the leaders are, of course, under house arrest, but the membership, the rank and file, is still active, and we will see whether they will be given the chance to take part in the upcoming parliamentary election next March. That is a big, that's a very important point, to see whether how much freedom they will be given to participate in the parliamentary election, but they are there.
Well, Hala Esfandiari, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Martin.
You're very welcome. And she directs the Woodrow Wilson Center's Middle East program. Back in 2007, she was held in solitary confinement for 105 days in Evin prison in Iran. She wrote about her experiences in a memoir called My Prison, My Home. And we called her up because yesterday, two American hikers, Josh Fatale, whose family lives in Elkins Park just outside of Philadelphia, and Shane Bauer, were released from that prison, flown to Oman, where they were met by their families. We're going to take another short break and get back to a conversation on something completely different about the Federal Reserve. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including a computer science degree certified by the National Security Agency, nationally accredited business programs, and research opportunities like the Liquid Life Laboratory. More details are available online at wcupa.edu. That's online at wcupa.edu.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A judge says companies have the right to reward employees who put work before family. What does that mean for new moms? Also, a how-to guide for a bad economy from the New Farmer's Almanac. For instance, reuse old greeting cards. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve announced that it was going to sell $400 billion worth of short-term debt and use the money to buy long-term securities. It dubbed the plan Operation Twist, based on similar actions done back in the 1960s. The Fed said it was worried about the slow pace of economic growth and hoped this move would lower interest rates and make borrowing more attractive. Well, yesterday, the Dow dropped more than 280 points, and today stocks are down in Europe and Asia and so far in the United States. And joining us to explain all of this is Jeff Sommer. He's business editor for the New York Times, writes a column for the Sunday business section called Strategies, and he hosts the Times Business Podcast. And Jeff Sommer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, let's go back, if we could, just a little bit of history to put what the Fed did into some kind of historical context. Let's go back to 1961. What was the problem back then?
The problem then was multifold. One main problem, I think, was that the economy was weak, much as it is now. There also was a problem with the balance of payments, and in those days, the United States was still on a gold standard, and when it was running a balance of payments deficit, it meant that gold stocks were being depleted, were going overseas. So the hope was to take some kind of a measure to solve all of these problems at once. This was under the new Kennedy administration.
And did they do what the Fed wants to do today?
They did something rather similar. That's where the name Operation Twist that you mentioned comes from. It comes from that 1961 effort. You know, it comes from the song that was a huge hit by Chubby Checker and 1960. By 1961, you know, everyone knew the song. Everyone was doing the twist. And the notion back then was that the Fed should, it did something slightly different from what they're doing now, and this is the difference.
Okay.
In those days, because of the gold standard, because they were worried about the strength of the dollar, they wanted short-term interest rates actually to rise a little bit. And they wanted long-term rates to decline. Right now, there is no desire to make short-term rates rise. There's no reason to do that. In those days, they actually attempted to get the short-term rates to rise, the long-term rates to fall, and that was the twist. You know, one direction, one hip is going one way, the other hip's going the other way. And they were the question was, how effective was all of that? There have been a lot of studies. There had been thought for some time, I would say, up through the 90s. Even Ben Bernanke is one of the people who studied it. The thought was that it wasn't all that effective. Using newer techniques, economists have looked at it, and now the thought is that, yes, it probably did stimulate the economy a bit back then, and perhaps it will now.
I'm embarrassed to say I know how to do the twist.
As do I.
Just to put all this into some kind of...
I'm hoping you'll play it here.
Well, but actually, you know, it was so played yesterday, we decided
right.
we're just going to keep it clean and just talk about this. So if it sort of worked back in the 60s, why do you think the Fed, and there wasn't unanimous agreement on this, but why do you think the Fed decided to do this now?
And by the way, there wasn't unanimous agreement. The head of the Fed's district in Philadelphia is one of the dissenters and has been for quite some time.
Right down the street from us, actually. But yeah, go ahead.
But why did they do it? this allows them to essentially use securities that are already in their portfolios. They don't have to go out and start to buy a lot of new securities and essentially create a lot more money. And they've come under some criticism in this political season for the actions they've taken already. So they didn't. I'm surmising that they didn't want to go too far, and yet they wanted to take some action to stimulate the economy. So what they've effectively done, as you said in your summary, is that they are. And by the way, they're doing two things. I'll mention the second thing in a moment that you haven't mentioned. But the main point of Operation Twist is indeed to sell off some of the shorter-term securities and to use that money, which they've already got in their portfolio, to just shift it to longer-term securities. And the effect of that, again, as you said, is to lower longer-term rates. Now, the markets are supposed to be sort of discounting machines that they use the information that's out there and people are predicting what's going to happen. A lot of people had expected this would happen. So longer-term rates have been dropping for a while now. But yesterday, they really dropped substantially. I would say that's an indication that the markets were surprised by the size of this, the 400 is a bigger number. I think people were expecting less, maybe 300. The second thing that they're doing, which I guess we haven't discussed so far, is that they are specifically targeting the mortgage market, and they are buying. They are now allowing some of their securities that, as they redeem their securities, they're going to be buying new mortgage-backed securities. The point of that is specifically to drive down mortgage rates, and the point of that, of course, is to do something for the housing market. In the middle of all of this, of course, we have an economic slowdown in the United States, and we have a global crisis that is really, I would say, more severe in Europe right now than it is in the United States. But all of this is weakening the American economy, and it's not clear that there will be immediate fiscal stimulus because of the disputes in Washington between the White House and the Republican-controlled House. And that leaves the Fed as the only game in town for immediate action.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions then, because what I heard from some analysis this morning was that the markets, and they did go down, they dropped yesterday afternoon. The Dow dropped about 280 points. Stocks were down in Europe and Asia. Don't look so good this morning. But the markets were essentially responding to Bernanke's words.
Yes.
His sense of pessimism, even gloom, about the future of the U.S. economy.
I think that's true. There was a phrase in the statement of the Federal Open Markets Committee, that's the Fed policymakers who took this action. I think they said that, quote, strains in global financial markets could further damage prospects for recovery. Growth remains slow. They talked about significant weakness. This was a shift in the language. You know, following the Fed is like deciphering the words of an oracle,
yes,
or the old days, reading Pravda closely for small changes. This was definitely a signal of greater weakness. That outlook has been emanating from many sources, but it's disturbing to hear it from the Federal Reserve.
Well, let me just stop you there, because, and I will quote from the Fed, and it seems to me there's nothing new here. Growth remains slow. Recent indicators point to continuing weaknesses in overall labor market conditions, and the unemployment rate remains elevated. Household spending has been increasing at only a modest pace in recent months. That's not news to anybody, is it? But when the Fed says it, people then react?
Yes, I agree. It's not news, but if you look closely, again, there are some subtle changes in language in one or two spots, and I'm having trouble. It's not, the language is not scintillating.
No, it isn't.
It won't excite anyone, but I believe they added the word significant in describing. Yes, here. They said that, quote, there are significant downside risks to the economic outlook.
And it's the word significant that seems to be resonating?
Yes. It's just one click more negative. And I guess the thought, and when I say I guess, because who knows, the markets, we're acting as though the markets are rational in this discussion, and that's a whole other topic. You know, that is not entirely clear. But to the extent that the markets are rational and are reacting to specific things, that would be it. It's that the outlook is grim. The Fed has taken some action. As I said earlier, the action was, in the bond market, I think, taken as greater than expected. But, you know, in the stock market overall, it is being viewed probably as a sign that things are bad and the Fed is somewhat hamstrung, even though its Operation Twist is a bit bigger, it's swinging it a little bit more wildly than anticipated. It's still not going in and launching an entirely new program of quantitative easing. You know, that's the general phrase for intervening in the markets by buying longer-term securities. They are buying longer-term securities, but as we've said, they're using the money already in their own portfolio. They're not expanding the size of the portfolio. That remains an option we shall see down the road.
So the Fed wants people, what, to borrow money and buy things and spend that money and buy houses or put that money into the economy? Is that what the Fed wants people to do by this Operation Twist?
Yes, I would say that that's the case. I would also say, though, that Bernanke probably wants to do what he said he wanted to do when they started the last round of quantitative easing. That was last summer. He was very explicit then in saying not only that he wanted the kind of actions that you've just described, but he also wanted asset prices across the board to rise, that in essence, by driving down the rate that you get on what is often considered to be a risk-free asset, and we can talk about that, you know, how risk-free are U.S. Treasuries now, but sure, they're supposed to be risk-free assets. You're getting paid almost nothing for them, and in fact, there are some arguments that you are now being, you are paying the government for the privilege of holding them because of inflation. You may actually be getting a negative real interest rate. So that should push a rational investor into putting his or her money elsewhere, perhaps into the stock market. So ultimately, it is supposed to drive up asset prices, I would say. However, as you've pointed out, short term, it may be having the opposite effect because people are getting all shaken up.
Well, and people, and I mean the millions of people that don't have jobs or underwater in their houses or are worried about, you know, paying for their child's education, for health care, you know, lowering already low rates. I just wonder. Would an individual think, oh, gosh, you know, now I'm going to take advantage of this low rate and go out and buy something?
Well, you're absolutely right. Probably not. That is a problem. The only benefit, I guess, that one can imagine for people like that, and many folks just can't borrow either. You know, this works well if you have a strong balance sheet. If you already are fairly well off, you can now borrow money at lower rates. If you can't borrow money from the outset, this won't help you very much. It might help you, though, in the sort of trickle-down effect of the economy getting a little bit better, you know, people, or at least not getting worse. You know, maybe this is just mitigating the problem somewhat so that you have more people going out and, you know, buying sandwiches, you know, at the food cart as opposed to just buying the food at the supermarket, and then that money gets spent elsewhere and so forth, and there's a little more money to go around.
Is the Fed running out of tools to deal with the U.S. economy?
That's a very good question. I don't think they're running out of tools. I think there's a question as to how effective the tools will be. Ben Bernanke is really is one of the great experts on all of this. He would have been considered one of the great experts if he were now still a professor at Princeton. He'd be one of the people you might be wanting to call to ask, you know, what could the Fed do? He spent a lot of time thinking about this. He says over and over again that there are many tools in the toolkit. There are other things they can do. They tend to be relatively obscure. you know, some of the other things that they haven't tried. Things like right now the Fed is paying banks a certain interest rate for holding reserves at the central bank, and they could eliminate that that interest, and that might induce banks to spend to use that money in more productive manners, to lend it out. There's a downside to that, though, which would be that it will hurt money market funds, which are already barely scraping by. As I mentioned earlier, the Fed could very well just enlarge its portfolio. You know, it's not enlarging it right now. It could buy a lot more securities. That would be very controversial mm-hmm. right now for mm-hmm. it to do so, but it does have that ability. It could do several other things that have not been tried before, but that Ben Bernanke has discussed explicitly. Those are like targeting specific interest rates, unemployment rate, even the GDP. The Fed could say openly that it will have an accommodative monetary policy until the GDP hits a certain level.
We're almost out of time here. Maybe an unfair question to you, Jeff. Do you think this will work? Or is it just it's too complicated?
Right. It's a rough question. I think it will. It depends, you know, as Clinton said, you know, it depends on what is. What
yes.
do you mean by work here? I think it will. I think it will work in the sense that it will have a somewhat stimulative effect. I think that the economy will be more robust than it would have been without this. But if the question is, do I think this will resolve the housing problem? Will it be the difference between a robust economy and a very weak economy? No, I don't think so.
Well, on that note, Jeff Sommer, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a business editor for the New York Times, writes a column for the Sunday Business section called Strategies, and he hosts the Times Business Podcast. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can check out our podcasts and Facebook and Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.